morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Today we have an article from Eric Bengel of The Daily Historian. Eric wrote about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how its passage could impact us here on the North Coast if Oregon LNG is allowed to proceed. But first, we look at the issue of transgender military service. 4 years after the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Department of Defense is preparing to lift the ban on transgender service in the military. Last summer, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter formed a working group to study the particulars of what needs to be done to move forward. As the Pentagon considers the change, practically speaking, transgender service members have to walk a fine line between regulations and their identity. Correspondent Patricia Murphy has the report.
The Peace household in Spanaway, Washington, can be a very busy place.
Are y'all gonna be nice?
Captain Jennifer Peace and her wife Debbie have been married for 11 years. They have three kids, cats, and two dogs.
You can say hi, but you're not gonna jump.
Peace is an intelligence officer at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. She deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan as a man. And though her evaluations were good, she struggled with the way her body looked, with depression. So nearly 2 years ago, with her wife's support, Peace started medically transitioning from male to female. It was a decision that had potentially devastating consequences for her career.
I was scared the entire time. Me and Debbie had so many conversations about what are we going to do if I do get kicked out. You know, I've got three kids and a mortgage just like everyone else. And this is what I know is the Army. What do I do if it's gone tomorrow?
The Army didn't discharge Peace. She's still an intelligence officer. And the Pentagon is now moving toward allowing transgender people to serve openly. Under an order from Secretary Carter, involuntary discharges for transgender service members must now be reviewed by a senior Pentagon official. It's part of Carter's efforts to make the military more diverse.
Because we need to be a meritocracy. We have to focus relentlessly on our mission, which means the thing that matters most about a person is what they can contribute to national defense.
But until the Defense Department crafts formal policies about transgender service members, Peace is in a complicated and sometimes frustrating position. She's been ordered to get her hair cut shorter, like a man's. Even though she has legally changed her name, Peace's soldiers are under orders to address her as Sir. And when they didn't do it, everyone was reprimanded.
My soldiers were called in and they said, "What are you calling Captain Peace? What were you told to call Captain Peace?" And there was finally a thing where I was called in and my direct supervisor said, "Hey, Captain Peace, I need you to start correcting people's pronouns."
Haircuts and pronouns will likely be addressed by Secretary Carter's working group, as will some potentially bigger issues, like whether transgender troops will be excluded from any military jobs. Aaron Belkin is the director of the Palm Center, an independent research institute that focuses on gender, sexuality, and the military. He says the Pentagon faces a lot of policy decisions in the coming months, but he says British, Australian, and Canadian forces already have inclusive policies for transgender personnel.
In all of those experiences, sure, culture changes a bit because the troops aren't used to serving in general with openly transgender personnel, but the implementation issues are not difficult to solve.
The frustration for transgender troops now is the time it's taking to solve those issues. Sue Fulton, a former Army captain, is president of SPARTA, a not-for-profit that supports LGBT military veterans and their families.
We're in a situation where there's a widespread recognition that the old policies don't work and a strong intent to set the right policies, to do the right thing, to make sure they're doing the right thing is going to take time.
And Fulton knows she was in the first class of women to graduate from West Point. And while Jennifer Peace admits she's impatient, she's also hopeful.
I think by this time next year, we'll be talking about how well the implementation has gone.
She hopes by then the focus will be on her job performance and not her gender. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
In an article filed by Eric Bengel for The Daily Historian, We learn that the United States Department of Energy would be required to automatically approve applications to export LNG to partner countries. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, a proposed trade deal among the United States and 11 other Pacific Rim countries, could widen the international market for liquefied natural gas by legally obliging the United States Department of Energy to automatically approve all applications to export LNG to partner countries. If the controversial agreement goes forward, companies looking to ship LNG to Japan, for example, the world's number one LNG importer, would have their export applications granted without the Energy Department reviewing, modifying, or delaying them. The result could be greater demand for LNG and more LNG exports. All natural gas exporters need the approval of the Energy Department to sell to foreign buyers. Last year, the department granted Oregon LNG, an energy company seeking to build an LNG terminal and pipeline on Warrington's Skipanon Peninsula, a conditional license to export LNG to countries without free trade agreements. When foreign buyers do not have a free trade agreement with the United States, the Energy Department, in theory, must conduct a thorough public analysis to determine whether the gas exports are consistent with public interest before granting the license. That's according to the U.S. Natural Gas Act. When the foreign buyer is part of a bilateral or multilateral free trade agreement with the U.S. that, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, calls for national treatment for trade in natural gas, the Energy Department waives the analysis. Meaning, if Congress doesn't ratify the partnership, Oregon LNG has conditional authorization from the Energy Department to export to the 11 other TPP countries, pending environmental reviews and final regulatory approval. If Congress does ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Oregon LNG will have everything it needs from the Energy Department to export to them, no department reviews necessary. Removing the bureaucratic obstacles, like environmental reviews, to exporting goods offers an incentive for countries to sign free trade agreements with the United States. President Barack Obama said in 2009 the U.S. intended to join the TPP, hoping it would become a pillar of his administration's economic policy. Supporters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership argue that the increase in exports will boost the U.S. economy. The trade agreement would create an expanding network of countries with easy access to products like natural gas from the United States. Critics argue the partnership doesn't adequately address environmental factors, like the impacts of global climate change, factors that should be considered in any meaningful definition of public interest. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. Correspondent Tom Bonsi hears buzzing in the air and sees wings in the sky. No, not birds nor bees. Drones had his attention last week. Technology institutions are recognizing the need for training in design and engineering. It's a fast-growing industry. Companies are staking their claim in the skies of the Northwest. Company's unmanned aircraft subsidiary based in the Columbia River Gorge passed a milestone last week in commercializing drone technology.
All this week, Boeing's In Situ is flying a small surveillance drone to inspect rail line for BNSF Railway. This is happening in rural New Mexico using a repurposed military model called the Scan Eagle. In Situ's Charlton Evans says the flights are groundbreaking because the drone is flying long distances in the national airspace.
Our system's robust enough and the design assurance is high enough that we were able to prove that we could do this in a rural area on a limited basis without risk to people on the ground or in the air.
BNSF and InSitu are part of a select group of companies to partner with the FAA to work out logistical and safety protocols for commercial unmanned flying. The railroad hopes real-time video from drones can provide a more efficient means to check for obstructions or damage to the rails. I'm Tom Bonsley reporting.
Catapult-launched Scan Eagle is powered by aviation diesel. Evans said during the test flights, the cigar-shaped swept-wing aircraft cruised about 1,000 feet above the surface. The roughly 35-pound unmanned plane was equipped with a transponder that transmitted its position to air traffic control, similar to a small piloted aircraft. InSitu, based in Bingham, Washington, hopes to find civil and commercial uses for its best-known aircraft. Until now, the main customers for the defense contractor have been the U.S. and allied governments. To get access to a broader domestic market, the UAS industry needs the federal government to finalize rules for small drones in the national airspace. So now, if you want to go to college to learn how to build, design, fly, or fix a drone, your time has come. Many institutions of higher learning around the Northwest are recognizing that unmanned aircraft could become a key technology of the future. But the murky and evolving regulations for drone flying present a lot of hurdles to give hands-on piloting experience. Correspondent Tom Bonsi continues his report from Seattle. The catapult-launched Scan Eagle is powered by aviation diesel. Evans said during the test flights, the cigar-shaped swept-wing aircraft cruised about 1,000 feet above the surface. The roughly 35-pound unmanned plane was equipped with a transponder that transmitted its position to air traffic control, similar to a small piloted aircraft. InSitu, based in Bingham, Washington, hopes to find civil and commercial uses for its best-known aircraft. Until now, the main customers for the defense contractor have been the United States and allied governments. To get access to a broader domestic market, the UAS industry needs the federal government to finalize rules for small drones in the national airspace. And now, if you want to go to college to learn how to design, build, fly, or fix a drone, your time has come. Many institutions of higher learning around the Northwest are recognizing that unmanned aircraft could become a key technology of the future. The murky and evolving regulations for drone flying present lots of hurdles to give hands-on piloting experience. Correspondent Tom Bonsi continues his report from Seattle.
How cool is this? A lab class where the homework includes building robotic vehicles from scratch.
So once it's armed, you can throttle up.
16 students have gathered around a long conference table at the University of Washington with aeronautics research scientist Christopher Lum.
Great. Okay. So it's controllable and it's great. That's half the battle then.
A student presenter holds down the small drone with his fingers to keep it from lifting off, which makes Lum nervous.
Tell you what, let's cut. This doesn't look super safe right now, the way we've got the protocol set up.
The UW's Autonomous Flight Systems Laboratory is working on how civilian drones can safely share the skies with manned aircraft. Other research universities in the Northwest have added programs that play to traditional strengths. For example, drones in forestry at Oregon State University and for automating farming tasks at Washington State University. Community colleges are the latest to get in the act. At least half a dozen schools in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington are standing up vocational drone operator courses. Within the last year, Central Oregon Community College in Bend and Green River College in Auburn, Washington, established Associate of Applied Science degrees in unmanned aerial systems. At the University of Washington, senior Ryan Volek savors his 3 years in the autonomous flight lab.
One of the coolest parts is the collaboration we get to do with industries and all the cool technology we get to work with. It's definitely an opportunity that a lot of students don't usually get.
Aeronautics and astronautics master's student Ward Handley wasn't as sold at first.
I specifically decided, no, I do not want to work on drones because of the privacy issues.
But then came an offer for a paid position in a drone lab, Handley says his initial negative perception has radically changed.
I'd like to see them used for good rather than ill. I think there are enough good applications for them that are really useful to society so that it is worthwhile to pursue these things.
A challenge for many academic programs is finding a place to fly legally. At Blue Mountain Community College in Pendleton, students fly inside the college gym. UW student Alec Buing in Seattle showed me his department's flight test range for small copters.
Just a conference room that we move the tables and chairs out of the way for. Make sure to bring the blinds down so if it happens to get out of control towards the windows, we minimize any damage.
Why indoors? Lum says it takes a very long time for everyone besides hobbyists to get official permission to fly a drone outside.
The federal regulations are a little bit stifling on that front. We need to file for paperwork. We need to register our aircraft. We need to obtain what's called a certificate of authorization or waiver.
All of which take months. And that's why Lum says he and some of his students have relocated to more accommodating Australia for the past two summers to log flying time. A Western Washington University professor took his department's two drones across the border to British Columbia for the same reason. The prospects for graduates in this field look good. A bunch of the seniors I met in Seattle were getting invitations to job interviews long before graduation. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
And now what you've been waiting for. Get out the white bucks and pinstripe shirts. We have a little Pat Boone on the way. We hear a final report this morning from Chris Lehman, who I must report was so excited to bring this to you, it was sent with triple exclamation points. But before you get too dreamy, he went to Bayshore, Oregon, and the love letters in the sand began to feel like sand, well, somewhere else. Many of us enjoy long walks on the beach, but when you live on the beach and the sand threatens to overrun your house and your driveway, it might not seem quite so romantic anymore. But can a governmental agency deal with the problem of too much sand? Correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
I'm standing on the beach in Bayshore, Oregon, and the Pacific Ocean is literally lapping at my feet right now. And as I turn and look about 500 feet inland, I can see a row of houses, but I can only see the roofs of most of the houses because there are giant sand dunes that have formed in between here and the houses, dunes that weren't here when this neighborhood was developed in the 1960s.
It's been a real problem for a long time.
And Marcella Bradawe says it's not simply a problem of beachfront views disappearing behind a mountain of sand. Bradawe is president of the local homeowners association. She says winter storms blow sand inland, piling it up to the eaves of some houses, covering driveways and even roads. That's a concern for emergency responders. But Bradawe says no one here is surprised by any of this.
They know it when they move there, so it's not like they are tricked or anything. It's obvious that there is a sand issue there.
The sand spit, like sand spits do, it wants to move.
Anno Husing is with the Lincoln County Planning Department. Bayshore is unincorporated, so locals turn to the county when issues like this come up. And Husing has learned a lot about sand over the years.
I've been called the Sandman, among other things.
Bayshore residents aren't always happy with the options Husing gives them. In the old days, local construction companies would gladly remove the sand to use as raw material in building projects. These days, a web of state and federal regulations governs sand management. So Husing says it isn't that no one knows how to get rid of the stuff.
Sand is a very nice medium to move around. You know, you get a big couple pieces of equipment, you can move a lot of sand very quickly.
And a lot of that sand will blow right back during the next storm. Long-term solutions involve moving the sand to lower elevations along the beach, planting beach grass, or installing fences similar to what are used to control snowdrifts in other parts of the Northwest. The county says it can't bankroll a project that will only benefit a handful of its residents. That's why the community wants to form what would be Oregon's first sand control district. It would be a taxing body that exists solely to manage sand. It's possible thanks to a law approved earlier this year by Oregon lawmakers, but not everyone in Bayshore wants to be a part of it. Rhonda Jansen lives about a half block inland. That's enough to put her house outside the big sandy mess.
Anytime this area gets in the paper, it becomes like a National Enquirer scandal sheet, and it's like, oh, everybody here has a sand problem, which is not the case. It's just one street.
The exact boundaries of the sand control district are still being determined. It would have to be approved by voters within its boundaries. But Cameron LaFollette of the Oregon Coast Alliance says Bayshore residents shouldn't limit the new district just to people with sand up to their windows.
The ocean and the shore are so dynamic. And what I do on my property is almost certainly going to affect your property, even if you're at the other end of the beach. And it might not affect it this year, but it might affect it 3 years from now when we have a big storm.
LaFollette says many of the homes in Bayshore probably shouldn't have been built in the first place. And that brings up this odd footnote. Bayshore exists thanks in part to singer Pat Boone.
On a day like today.
Boone invested in a company that helped develop the community. A hotel there bore his name for many years. One of Boone's big hits, a song called Love Letters in the Sand. I'm Chris Lehman in Bayshore, Oregon.
How you laughed when I cried each time I saw the tide take our love letters from the sand.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of the program, you can hear it on a podcast at our website at coastradio.org. We enjoy hearing from you. Email questions or comments to News One. That's N-E-W-S and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thanks for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge.